Well, welcome everyone. Thank you all for coming. Before I introduce our speaker, as usual, I'm going to give you a spiel about the upcoming events because I want a lot of people to show up, so I hope that you will spread the news. We have one more lecture at the end of the month, actually the beginning of April. April the 1st, we have a lecture by Tahar Shahinyan, who's a graduate of UCLA, a very, very fine scholar and incredible person, who's going to be speaking to us about literary theory in Armenian literature and a small literary group of Armenians in Paris in the 1920s, post-genocide, the main group, I believe. So please do show up for that one. And then the crescendo of this year, as you know, is obviously April 24th is the 100th anniversary. UCLA is doing its best to provide a respectable kind of setting and an atmosphere in which to address the issue of commemorating the genocide. And we have a two-day conference that begins on the 10th of April that includes a whole day of back-to-back panels by really some of the best scholars in the world. I don't want to exaggerate too much, but I can't think of a better collection of scholars who deal with genocide and Holocaust than the ones who have accepted kindly to be here for the conference. And then we have, and one of those scholars has just walked in. So, and then we have, on the same evening, on the 10th, we have, from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock, a really important event at Schoenberg Hall, capacity of 500. So I hope we will have at least, at the very least, half of that hall filled. And it will be a three keynote lectures provided by three distinguished speakers who have every gravitas and seriousness in the world to address the question of the 100th anniversary. And these include our very own Professor Richard Ovanisyan, followed by Ron Suni, and last but not least, Professor Murat Belge from Istanbul Bilgi University, who is a renowned public intellectual in Turkey, a man who was confident about taking stands on principled issues before they became fashionable in the beginning of the 1990s. He's also a literary critic and translator of Faulkner and James Joyce. So we have that evening of 3 hours of being offered hopefully piercing, illuminatory kind of talk on the genocide on the 100th anniversary, interspersed with musical interludes, with three musical interludes performed by the local UCLA Armenian musical ensemble under the direction of Moftes Pogosyan. And then Saturday, the following day, we have back-to-back panels as well from 9:30 until 5:30 in the evening. So I do encourage you all to show up and please share the news. There's information on this event on the UCLA History, Armenian History website. I think it's called the Richard Ovanisyan Modern Armenian History Chair website. If you go to the department's website, you can find it at the bottom. We also have been blasting out information on the conference to our listeners. So if none of you, or some of you are not on the listserv, please talk to Mary Monjong. There are only a select few of you here, so it's not likely that a whole bunch of you are going to assault her with overwhelm her with the request to be put on. But if you're not on, please do speak to us. So today we have, I'm very honored to host and welcome a friend and an excellent scholar, Rachel Goshkarian, whom I met, I think, the first time in 1999 in Venice, but I'm not sure, around that time in a summer program in Venice, one of Higher Devon's summer programs. Rachel is an assistant professor of history at Lafayette College. She has published articles and collections by I.B. Torres and Princeton, as well as with the British Journal of Middle Eastern Studies. She is finishing currently her first manuscript project on the homosociality and urban self-governance in late medieval Anatolia. That's bound to raise some eyebrows in this audience. Very interesting dissertation, which is being prepared at the moment for publication as a book. She is also co-editing a volume on landscape and architecture in Anatolia 1100 to 1500 and has finished a PhD, obviously, at Harvard University in 2008 with, under the competent and talented supervision of Jamal Kapadar, one of the most renowned Ottomanists in North America at least. She is the author of the first language grammar published in Turkey in over 100 years, known as Kendi, Kendine Ermenice. It's a self-help book for Turkish speakers. And I have the distinct pleasure of introducing her today, welcoming her to give us a talk on Ottoman displacements, geographies and specialities in the world of a 17th century Armenian author in Kefe, Kafa Theodosia in the Crimea. Obviously a topic that I believe touches on Armeno-Turkish, which is a hybrid kind of heterographic language and literature that I believe in the next 10 years we'll probably see more and more attention devoted to it. So thank you, Reggie.
All right, thank you so much, Sevlu. Thank you to the Richard Papanisyan Chair of Armenian History in the History Department at UCLA. I'm very happy to be here today and to share with you kind of a new project that I've been working on for about the past 6 months or so. It's a project that I think helps us to understand the ways in which some Armenians, at least living in the 17th century, experienced the world around them. So imagine a cold, damp fall night on the northern shores of the Black Sea. It's sometime in the 1640s, and you're an Armenian man living in Kafa, a city to which you recently migrated from Tokat, your Anatolian birthplace, in the aftermath of a series of local rebellions. You're gathered in a communal space, maybe a coffee house, the social section of a church, or a kind of a clubhouse, with other men, some locals and some migrants like yourself. An acquaintance pulls out a leather-bound manuscript filled with what you recognize as Armenian letters, painted on its yellow pages in red and black, with some bird-like designs in the margins. Many in the room show interest in this man and the book he wants to share with the crowd. They turn their heads towards him as he begins to read aloud. Hani ey sava yüzüler, hani ey şirin sözüler, gör nice kayıp olmuş onlar, hiç belirmez nişanları. Basically, this translates as, where are those ones with the faces bearing the good news? Where are the sweet-tongued ones? Look how much they've lost. They don't even understand the signs. The above excerpt is from an actual leather-bound poetry compilation that was completed in Kafa in 1641. Here you can see where Kafa is on the Black Sea. I really like this map because it shows us the progression with which the Ottomans were able to expand and build their empire. So here you can see that it's very well color-coded. Kafa is up there to the north of the Black Sea and what's now known as the Crimea. And it was acquired by the Ottomans basically during the reign of Mehmed II in the late 15th century. So this manuscript was completed in about 1641 in the city of Kafa by an Armenian deacon named Mikhail. This poem that I just read, he cites as being said by Tatios, or Tatios Asatyan. If there's such a great resemblance to a stanza attributed to the man that is considered the father of Turkish poetry, Yunus Emre, that one begins to understand that Turkish was not uniquely a language of functionality and necessity for Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire, but that some Armenians who spoke Turkish both participated in and perpetuated an oral and written Turkish literary culture. The same compilation also contains a series of poems, well, the majority of poems in the compilation are composed in Armenian, suggesting that the scribe and the individual or group for whom he had basically constructed or compiled this series of poems spoke both Armenian and Turkish. This is an image of the manuscript that's from the Mkhitaryan Monastery of Venice. And San Lazaro, sorry, this is so. In the Greek language preface to his 1850 Ottoman grammar book, Konstantin Adosidis, by all accounts a Greek member of the Ottoman elite, compared the Armenian and Greek communities with regard to their distinct approaches to the Turkish language. Dear Greek compatriots, it is a matter of regret or rather no little shame for us, the subjects of the Ottoman Empire, who lived cheek by jowl with the Ottomans, governed by their laws, that we remain indifferent about this language, regarding which our colleague peoples in the empire, the Armenians and the Armenian Catholics, put themselves to the utmost trouble, both privately and publicly, and this applies not only to the Ottoman, but also to the Persian and Arabic languages. If, in the 19th century, it seemed clear to this man, to this Greek Ottoman statesman, that Armenians were much less indifferent to Ottoman, Persian, and Arabic languages than their Greek counterparts were, modern scholarship on the Ottoman Empire has lagged behind in its appreciation of the myriad sources available to scholars composed in Armeno-Turkish from the 14th through the 20th centuries. Now, the earliest examples of Armeno-Turkish are generally found in the form of poetry, Macaronic poetry, which basically means that there's both Armenian and Turkish in the poem. Most Armenologists say that the first instances of this is in the 14th century, which would place it after the first instance of Ottoman Turkish actually being written, or of Old Turkish actually being written in Arabic scripts. But I actually found this manuscript, which is from the late 13th century, predating the initial use of the Arabic alphabet to write down Turkish in Anatolia, was the Armenian alphabet, as far as this one instance suggests. So this is written by Tasios of Sokot, who is very well known as a miniaturist. And this is a poem that he wrote about an earthquake that took place in Erzincan in 1287. So you can see at the top it says, Baronun özgür kağıtın tüket, minşi patet knat çapar. So the Lord left his city and went until Bayburt running. Bugün vereyim sana heba değil safurlağı hafar, haftan gezi bize zaval, etc. So the rest of the poem is in Turkish and describes the earthquake that had taken place in Erzincan in 1287. Because of its usage in Macaronic poetry, much Armeno-Turkish has been associated with minstrelsy, performed generally by multilingual Armenian ashuls or gusans. In fact, in one of his studies on Turkish folk literature, the preeminent Ottoman historian and historian of Ottoman and Turkish literature, Fuat Köprülü, in 1966, explored the connections between the content and style of Armenian and Turkish lyric poetry. Ottoman historians are generally familiar with two important and relatively well-known Armeno-Turkish texts composed in Istanbul, one being Eremya Çelebi Kumburgian, 17th century Jewish Bride, the play, and the other Varkan Pasha's Akabi Hikayesi, or the story of Akabi, which is considered the first novel composed in Turkish and was published in 1851. Armenians consistently composed works in Turkish, however, far beyond Istanbul and throughout the empire from at least the 16th through the 20th centuries with quite the degree of regularity. The voluminous Turkish language academic work of Kevor Pamukcan, who recently died in 1996, has recently been compiled and placed into four major editions in Istanbul by Osman Kutaj. And these works offer expansive insights into the range and quantity and quality of works penned in Armeno-Turkish and the many uses that Armenian language and Armeno-Turkish sources offer not only to historians of Armenian history, but also to historians of Ottoman history. It would seem, however, that most Ottomanists have had a tendency to shy away from using Armeno-Turkish as a means of getting at myriad aspects of the Ottoman past. In fact, aside from a few unique examples, Armeno-Turkish texts have almost uniquely been used by historians to consider Armenian history in the context of the Ottoman Empire, rather than to look at larger stories of the empire itself. In Yerevan, I think I have a picture of, this is Kevor Pamukcan. he did an incredible amount of work, a seriously incredible amount of work. It has, all of it has recently been compiled, as I said, by Osman Köket, thanks to Aras Publishing House, which most of you, I'm sure, know, which is a very important place for Armenian intellectual life in Istanbul today. In Yerevan, Hatmik Stepanyan has recently published two significant Armenian language catalogs of Armeno-Turkish resources. One lists Armeno-Turkish publications, and the other records basically all of the Armeno-Turkish manuscripts housed in the largest Armenian manuscript repository named after Mesrop Mashtots and located in Yerevan. With these two important publications, Stepanyan has basically exposed the sheer volume of texts composed in Armeno-Turkish. She shows that the manuscripts composed between the 14th and 19th centuries that are either uniquely in Armeno-Turkish or that employ Armeno-Turkish in parts of them cover a wide range of topics, everywhere from poetry to history to art history to theology, and that they were composed in a very large geographical range, so from Calcutta to Istanbul to Varna. Still, some Armenologists, Stepanyan included, have a tendency to categorize Turkish as a language that Armenians were forced to use because, as she says in her introduction, Muslims could kill Christians for no reason. This highly problematic analysis clearly limits consideration of the relationship between Armenians and the Turkish language, let alone an understanding of the various kinds of connections and relations, communal, economic, political, personal, religious, social, etc., between Armenians and others living in the Ottoman Empire, right? Because Turkish was not uniquely the language of Turks, it was the language of the empire. Some scholars have suggested that Armeno-Turkish was written primarily by Armenians who did not know Armenian, and that only used Turkish and held on to the unique 5th century alphabet designed by Mesrop Mashtots to preserve a part of their identity. Still, the early, consistent, and diverse usages of Turkish by Armenians and its regular recording alongside Armenian in manuscripts points to an intimate and involved Armenian engagement with the Turkish language. It also shows that Turkish was not used uniquely to the exclusion of Armenian, and especially not in the medieval or early modern worlds. While there were, of course, communities that only used Turkish, many Armenians were bilingual or multilingual. And we know, for example, of the many Armenian dictionaries that were composed and created in the 19th century were multilingual, right? Suggesting that many literate Armenians knew more than just one language. This one is from, is this Chakchakyan? Yeah, so this is Chakchakyan, right, published in Venice in the early 19th century. And this is Italian, Armenian, and Turkish dictionary. And then here we have another composed by the brothers Aristakes and Stefano Azarian, which is Greek, Italian, Armenian, and Turkish, also from the 19th century. While some academics have long called for a deeper analysis of Armeno-Turkish literature, comparatively little work has been done in this particular field, in spite of the large number of sources available. Of course, the status of the study of Armeno-Turkish cannot be separated from the field of Armenian and Ottoman historical study. Recent work in both fields questions previously held notions about ethnic, linguistic, and religious identities, and both Armenian and history and Ottoman history have become recently increasingly open to using sources composed in a range of languages that help us to tell the stories of the past from different angles. In reflecting upon the volume of texts composed in Armeno-Turkish throughout the Ottoman Empire, one can't help but understand that Armenians, whether monolingual, bilingual, or multilingual, were engaged with oral and written Turkish linguistic and literary cultures. But what does that mean? What does that tell us about Armenians who lived in the Ottoman Empire? And what does that tell us about the Ottoman Empire itself? Considering the manuscript I mentioned above, composed by an Armenian who lived in Kaffa, it offers us a kind of a case study in the ways in which Armenian and Turkish languages were used simultaneously. The compiled manuscript is essentially a poetic a poetry compilation, right? It's called the Zahara. It includes Macaronic poems, poems in Armeno-Turkish, and poems in Armenian. So the gross majority of the manuscript's texts are composed in Armenian, so about 60 are composed in Armenian, 6 are composed uniquely in Armeno-Turkish, and 2 are composed in Macaronic form, so Armenian and Armeno-Turkish. At first glance, the manuscript seems in some ways a straightforward poetic compilation, basically typical of an early modern church-educated Armeno-Ottoman, from Kafa or from anywhere, really. It's filled with various themes that are familiar to a historian of the literature of this time period. Religious topics, advice literature, love, feasting and fun, flowers, nightingales, etc. Upon closer examination, however, the manuscript reveals itself to offer insights into the complicated ways in which an Armenian living in 17th century Kafa imagined and performed his varied identities. 1, as an Armenian, 2, as a Christian, 3, as a member of the clergy, 4, as an urbanite, 5, as a kefesi or kafalı, and 6, as an Ottoman. The languages and contents of the text composed or included by Mikhail offer us an opportunity to engage directly with important questions scholars have hitherto timidly posed about early modern Ottoman Armenians and the relationship of language and faith to the establishment of individual, communal, religious, and imperial identities. So the Armenian church and scriptoria of St. Sarkis was constructed in Kafa during the 14th century. These are the doors of the church of St. Sarkis, Sur Sarkis. Armenians had inhabited the city of Kafa from at least the 11th century. And by the 15th century were considered basically one of the most important communities in the city itself, running several churches, schools, banks, and trading houses. After the Ottoman conquest of the city, which took place in 1475, sources suggest an initial dip in the Armenian population of the city, actually along with every other population, but it was consistently considered an important center of Armenian both mercantile and intellectual activity. By the mid-17th century, however, the Armenian population of the city of Kafa was once again robust, and the metropolis was home to a number of Armenian churches that were quite active. The city was also home to relatively significant Greek, Jewish, Russian, and Tatar communities, and was consistently compared with Constantinople or Istanbul because of its quote-unquote cosmopolitan nature. While the 16th century Armenian communities of Crimea and Poland left only a few written works, the 17th century witnessed both an increase in the Armenian population of the region, thanks in part to the series of rebellions that took place in Anatolia, known as the Celali Rebellions. And along with this rise in population, we see a rise in the production of art and literature. Some of this literature, composed by Armenians, was composed in Armeno-Kupchak and has been the subject of serious study since the mid-20th century. However, some of those Armenians who migrated to Kafa in the 17th century after they were forced out of their homeland because of the series of rebellions. The rebellions were not uniquely directed against Armenians. They were rebellions that were taking place in where there were a series of generals who had, or of soldiers who had been basically displaced from the Ottoman Empire, and then they were trying to regain power in various regions within the empire. It affected all of the populations of particularly central and eastern Anatolia, and of course amongst those were Armenians. So many of them were forced out or left basically because of the depressed economic state and the series of basically mini wars that were taking place between the Ottoman regular forces and those forces that had become sort of disenfranchised from the Ottoman military apparatus. So the Armenians who left Tokat to go to Kafa seem to have continued to reproduce texts written in the Turkish that they had learned in their Armenian homeland. So rather than start to write in Kupchak or Tatar, they were reproducing texts that they had, I guess, been exposed to or shared with others in their own hometowns. This is at least the impression that we are given by Deacon Mikhail's manuscript. So in this particular poetic text, this particular series of poetic texts, about 30 of the Armenian language poems are dedicated to religious matters. They focus either on the Christian faith or on the performance of, you know, or offer basically performative instruction, like basically how do you do a baptism, stuff like this. Another 15 are advice literature, right, or basic parables imbued with instruction. Another 10 kind of embrace food and feasting, or flowers and nature. They're kind of the fun part of the manuscript. Two are focused on the praise of the city of Kaffa itself, the city to where this guy, Mikhail, has recently migrated. Another is a lamentation on Galibutyun, or being distant from home, the sadness associated with being a migrant. One is what appears to be a very unique Armenian text on the practice of devşirme, which is known as the collecting. I'll explain that in a minute. But it's very unique. We don't have many Armenian, well, we have no other, to the best of my knowledge, no other Armenian texts that deal with this practice. And another is a history, Badmutyun, or a biography of the false prophet Muhammad and a condemnation of him. So you see it's quite a range of source material in one manuscript. The Armeno-Turkish text composed for or reproduced in this manuscript seems to belong to an oral tradition imbued with aspects of Anatolian Islamic mysticism. In many respects, aspects of Beşiktaşilik, which is a specific form of Anatolian mysticism that was basically started by a man in Hacı Bektaş. All but one of the Armeno-Turkish poems, although many of them resemble poetry that was composed in the 14th and 15th century by early Turkish Anatolian mystics, are attributed to an Armenian author. That these Turkish language poems are part of a larger collection of poetry filled with Armenian religious texts makes me question the ways in which we have understood the ways in which individuals experienced and performed their identities in the 17th century. For example, this collection suggests that the audience for which Mikhail kind of cobbled together this series of texts would have been members of a traditional Armenian church community who participated in the sacraments and enjoyed, to a certain degree, partying with wine and food, lived in the city of Kaffa, missed the hometowns in Anatolia from whence they basically had been exiled, were aware of and somewhat put off by the Ottoman practice of devşirme, considered the Prophet Muhammad and his teachings to be false, but were engaged with Turkish language poetry that focused on things like the insignificance of the material world, the importance of reading religious texts, including the Quran, and the terrible qualities of those individuals who don't perform Muslim ritual prayer, aspects of death and dying, and the beautiful lamentations of the nightingale. The picture painted here, then, would lead us to believe that in this particular instance, a certain degree of discomfort with Islam, criticism of the Ottoman state, did not translate into a rejection of Turkish or of Turkish religious poetry. In fact, it would seem that these elements existed in a kind of celebrated harmony in the mind of this Armenian deacon from Kaffa in the 17th century, and the manuscript that he put down in a beautiful but simple hand. So who was this Mikhail? We know very little about him other than what we can really glean from the manuscript. He was a deacon who lived in Kaffa and who knew Armenian and Turkish. Armenian authors developed a tendency to produce colophons in the medieval period, and they can offer us sometimes really great insight into the life of a scribe. In the case of our Mikhail, he actually composed no fewer than 3 colophons about himself. All 3 identify him as Deacon Mikhail. One offers us insight into the kind of personal struggles that must have plagued him. He writes in one of them, "When I see a woman, I desire to approach the door of misfortune. I go to the monastery and stay there, such that I neither see nor desire. This collection was written in 1641 in the month of December on the 19th day of Saturday by an unworthy hand. This is kind of the most personal information we can glean about Mikael, that he struggled either with love or with a kind of self-enforced celibacy, I mean, he was only a deacon, or simply with intellectual distraction. While he doesn't self-identify as a migrant from Anatolia, his collection includes a poem that compares exile to being far from a lover. Oftentimes I sit and cry for my exile. I am from a foreign country, and God knows where I should go and where I might last. Many 17th century Armenian language texts reflect upon the large contemporary emigrations of Armenians from Anatolia, from Anatolian cities like Amasya, Tokat, and Sivas, due to the Celali rebellions. These seemingly traumatic dispersions encouraged Armenian authors to begin, or seem to have encouraged Armenian authors to begin to look to Armenian history under the Ottomans for various examples of previous hardships, ushering in what became a widely popular narrative of consistent forcible displacement and an ever-lengthening distance from home. In a poem entitled On the Armenian Kings, the author, A Lamentation on the Armenian Kings, the author Mikael laments, "Wake up and see our pithy and pathetic pain. We know that of all the merciful nations, we are the most tread upon. We have neither a king nor an army of soldiers. Where are our first princes, Mushev the brave and Vahan the wolf? They should engage in war for us and free all of those who have been enslaved." Mikhail's manuscript also includes a reproduction of a lengthy description of the fall of Constantinople to the Ottomans, a long poem on the martyrdom of a young man, Armenian boy from Kafa, and a unique and original Armenian language complaint about the Deshiva. The poem on martyrdom, composed about a boy named Asvazadur from Kafa by the priest Prikor of Kafa, calls the nations of Muslims the enemies of the cross, or Khachitashnamik, and describes in great detail all of the physical torture that the good boy had to unfairly endure in the year 1488. At the same time, the poem on Devshirme, most likely an original by Mikhail himself, begins, "In the year 1530, during the kingship of the impure nation of Muslims, they asked for boys from the nation of Christians," and goes on to detail the process by which representatives of the state approached citizens in Kafa, asking for young children, how some individuals managed to escape basically to the monasteries, and how others were co-opted. The poem ends with the naming of those who were taken away as martyrs. Now, this particular text is very important. Devşirme was a practice, very common practice amongst the Ottomans from the earliest periods of the Ottoman Empire. The term Devşirme literally means the collecting. And really up until, there's supposedly some other mentions in Armenian texts, but this is the longest, I think most complete version of an Armenian complaint on Devşirme. One of the most popular complaints on this particular practice, which basically was a collecting, not just a collecting, but specifically a collecting of Christian boys, right, into the Ottoman system. Our best information about it in many respects comes from a sermon by a Greek-speaking Orthodox priest from the Balkans. And most Ottomanists concur that Devşirme was almost uniquely practiced in the Balkans, whereby once every 4 years, almost every village would have to sort of, the janissary, so you see these are, this is a janissary, he comes to the village, and then here are the boys that are being taken away. The goal is basically to take children from Christian communities, have them learn Turkish, have them learn something about Islam, make them a member of sort of the Ottoman administrative apparatus, and then they would split them basically into two groups. If you were smart, you got to do interesting things, like learn how to become an architect, etc. If you weren't that smart, you became a member of the military. So for the longest time, and this is part of an Ottoman, I mean, if you think about it from an imperial perspective, this was just really a very interesting way to sort of incorporate new populations into your administrative apparatus. Because imagine if you're, you know, a Greek-speaking Christian from somewhere in the Balkans, and your son is taken away, becomes part of the Ottoman administration. Well, it becomes harder and harder to maybe hate the Ottomans, right? Especially if he becomes famous. And as we know, some of them became not really famous, but if he became well respected and made a certain amount of money, oftentimes those individuals who became known as the kapukulada, or the servants of the state, would help to endow fountains and other things in the villages from whence they had left to go to Istanbul. So from an imperial practical perspective, it was an interesting way to sort of integrate new populations. Still, most research up until now suggests this only happened in the Balkans. Mikhail's text, Mikhail's poem, suggests this happened in Kaffa in the 15th or 16th century, and that is a very new piece of information, new historical information for our understanding of the way that Armenians were also integrated into the Ottoman Empire. So even though we have this like huge amount of negativity towards Muslims and towards the Ottoman state, right? He's criticizing the takeover of, or the conquest of Constantinople. He's criticizing the practice of Devşirmek. He's criticizing Muhammad and calling him a false prophet. There's still very much positivity about the Ottoman Empire in the entire compilation as well. For example, two of the texts are about the city of Kaffa, right? Supposedly this place that he's, or that many Armenians have been, you know, forcibly sort of displaced to. And at the end of one of the poems, which is basically called Asvad Tol Kaffa Shenbahe, right? This is sort of like the refrain. So in that particular poem, at the end, he not only asks God to bless the Armenian Patriarch of Constantinople, the Armenian Catholicos at Eshmiadzin, he also asks God to bless the Ottoman Sultan and his armies. Right? So this is a very complex kind of manuscript. Mikhail likens Kaffa to paradise, and to other holy cities like Rome and Istanbul. He insists upon its strong rampart and the Frankish, really Genoese fortress, and boasts of the boats, the scores and scores of fish that come into the city each day. He says, Kaffa is now the home of the Armenians, and all, the entire country is going there. He describes the many houses of worship of the city, both Christian and others, and implores God to keep the city of Kaffa prosperous. Of the Armenian Turkish poems, Asvad Tol Shenbahe Es Kaffa. Okay, these are the Armenian, okay. Of the Armeno-Turkish poems, three were likely composed by Mikhail, four were composed by Tasios of Tokat, who, as noted above, was a poet who wrote in Armenian and Turkish, and one was likely transmitted by a Turkish author, although that is not noted in particular in the manuscript. The two Macaronic poems by Mikhail are reflections on their constant relationship between the nightingale and the rose. This topos of rose and nightingale, or nightingale and rose, really had entered the Armenian literary tradition as early as the 13th century, when Konstantin of Erzincan, an Armenian poet who knew Persian, wrote a series of allegorical poems based on the sort of love relationship between the nightingale and the rose that was originally met with great misunderstanding by his brothers in the city of Erzincan, or Erzinka. He eventually had to write a poem explaining what this all meant, and he was very displeased with the fact that none of them seemed to understand what he considered was a very clear allegory for the relationship, the love relationship between man and God. Eventually, however, the rose and nightingale became a part of Armenian mystical poetry in the same way it did amongst Persian and Turkish speakers in the region. One of the poems composed by Mikhail in this particular manuscript begins, Figane başladım bülbüler gibi. And then it goes on in Armenian, the flowers. Do I have this one up here? Yes, Figane başladım bülbüler gibi. Vartne nester. Ir parts of Borbes Takuhi. Yeah, sorry. dağları gezerdim ben Mecnun gibi. And then tabalim tabalim ibera varti. So this is basically an example of how this Armeno Turkish works. He says, I started crying like, or I started singing or crying like the nightingales. The flower was seated above like a queen in Armenian. I basically searched, or I went throughout the mountains. I searched and searched for the rose. This is how you can see sort of the ease with which this particular author weaves in between both Armenian and Turkish languages. The Turkish poem on the Bey Namaz, which basically means the person that does not perform namaz or Muslim ritual prayer, begins with a title that reads, "We shame the Bey Namaz man," or "We shame the man who does not perform Muslim ritual prayer." There is a long description of all of the terrible things that this kind of prayerless person does, with the refrain reading, "Ayne kafur dur Bey Namaz," so that the Bey Namaz is similar to the kafir, or the non-Muslim. The poem is not attributed to any individual, but with all of its reference to Muslim practice, chances are it was written for a particularly Muslim audience. Still, one cannot be sure. And why did Mikhail even include this text in this particular compilation? Was it to show an understanding of Islam? Why would a generally Armenian, and based on the context of this particular manuscript, a relatively faithful and practicing Christian audience be interested in shaming a non-practicing Muslim individual? One of the paragraphs goes, Bey Namaz Şeytan Kardeşi, the Bey Namaz is the brother of Satan. Karadır içi dişi, his interior and exterior are very black. Secdeye koymaz başı, he doesn't place his head on the sejde or the Muslim prayer rug. Aynı kafurdur Bey Namaz. So the Bey Namaz is just like a kafur or non-Muslim. The poem ends with a final distinction between Muslims and non-Muslims. Namaza kılsan pir olur. So he who completes his ritual prayer can become a saint. Her kim kılmaz kafir olur. Who does not perform his ritual prayer becomes a non-Muslim. Olu uşağı kırılır. Boy and servants are offended, basically. Aynı kapurdur Bey Namaz. The Bey Namaz is again like a non-Muslim. Its final line reads definitive, Namazkar olun kardeşler, which means, you know, become those who pray, my brothers or my friends. This very shaming text, its insistence upon a separation between Muslims and non-Muslims as those who do not pray, and its encouragement of daily prayers, suggests a relatively decent understanding of Muslim practice and the lines that were drawn between those who engaged with the religious daily life and those who did not. Its presence in this compilation is surprising in as much as one would assume that the Armenian Christian audience reading or hearing the poem wouldn't much care about non-practicing Muslims. But why shouldn't they? If they were living with Muslims around them, and if they lived in a society that was somewhat regulated by religious communities, perhaps understanding what was appropriate and inappropriate for their neighbors was important to this resident of Kasach. Mikhail includes four poems written in Armeno-Turkish by Tateos of Tokas. All four are imbued with Islamic elements, and all four bear resemblance to certain mystical traditions present in Anatolia. As noted above, one of the poems at the beginning is very similar to a poem attributed to Yunus Emre. Both deal with the difference between those who are on the right path and those who stray from it. So, Dahi bunda gelmiyorlar, o benliğini bulmayalar, zudu tat kılmayalar, çün kaçıktır devranları. So it talks about someone who, these also don't come with us. They have lost their own sort of lordship. They no longer renounce the world. Zudu tat kılmayalar, çün kaçıktır devranları. Their times have passed. Tateus doesn't credit Yunus Emre with this poem, but actually offers credit for the poem to Aşık Paşa, who was another important 14th century Turkish poet. This conflation or simple error speaks at least to a certain kind of early modern engagement with the late medieval Turkish folkloric poetry and a lack of hesitancy in recognizing a well-known Muslim mystic. In another poem attributed to Tapeus, who's recognized as a pilgrim or Mahdisi, and most likely for having traveled to Jerusalem, the subject is love for the ineffable, or love for God. Tapeus begins this poem with a very common Turkish Muslim refrain, which is, not refrain, but saying, which is Hak Teala, or God the Great. Dilem bu, Hak Teala'dan dilem bu. My wish from God the Great is the following. And he goes on to describe his travel along the mystical path. That the poem begins with the phrase Hak Teala and continues along the lines of spiritual or romantic poetry that would be familiar to certain types of Muslims in Anatolia, shows that Tapeus was engaged with the mystical poetry of this early period. The author, like many before him, inserts himself into the poem as he signs off, remembering God as the creator of all and making reference to the physicality of his own eventual death. He says, Tatos düzündür maydan, hodadır seni yaratan, var eyledi, ben yo iken toprağa ferman olmuşum. He says, basically, let Tatios' words remain. It is God who has created you. When I'm not here, may my body be a command from the ground, from the earth. In another poem, he bargains with God, who he says, Yaratı teni ve canı, who basically created all that is physical and the spiritual, asking for his help in releasing him from the bond with his sins. He says, Günah çok yüzüm kara, my sins are many, my face is black, benim eksikliğim çoktur, there are many things that I'm missing, or many faults that I have. Ben beni kulluktan ayırmasan, zikr edeyim karşı. Basically asking people to, he says, basically saying that he will perform much zikr, or remembrance of God in the way that Muslims perform it, in order to compensate for his imperfections. Even here, the performance of zikr that is traditionally associated with Muslim practice rather than Christian seems normal in this context. The question becomes, did he just recycle this poem from another Turkish author? And does it really matter? Did Armenians also use the term zikr to describe the verbal and mental remembrance of God? The final poem included by Tatios is entitled Kimsenin Gönlün Yıkma and is a short of work of advice in human relations. The final line of the text, Sokma Aza Hatadır, is the refrain and feels almost like a line from a self-help book. Much of this poem is about how to treat other individuals. The one Armeno-Turkish poem that seems to have been written by Mikhail himself is a dark work on death and dying. He entitles the poem, A Lamentation in the Tajik Letter, Say It and Remember Its Author. It begins, Gelin bugün kardeşlerim, size kolayız benim için. Ben giderim hoşça kalın. So he's telling his friends, come today, my friends. I'm leaving, take care. İlham olsun benim için, say prayers for me. Dün gün gül gibi idim, yesterday I was like a rose. Yüzüm kızıl hazar dedim. My face was red. My tongue was ready. Nigah indi haktan hüküm. The poem continues in a similar fashion, lamenting the quick passage of time and describing in literal detail the burial of the author underground. It's really quite dark. He says, "Today I entered a black place. The earth is both my pillow and my mattress." Whoever reads the Bible and the Quran, the New Testament and the Psalms, give news. Whoever does not accept the truth that is shared there, his halal, or his permissible, is haram, is forbidden. So the last sentence is, Her kim tutmaz hak buyru, onun helali haramdır. So whoever doesn't accept the truth of the Old Testament, the Quran, the New Testament, and the Psalms, his permissible is not permissible. The last four poems, lines of this poem are particularly interesting. It's composed by Mikael, who seems to have understood something about Islam and Islamic practice. It would seem that the author is encouraging the reading of the Quran alongside the Bible, which is quite shocking if we think about the ways in which we understand Armenian history and the Ottoman Empire in general. The complexity of the content of this compilation sheds light on the way in which one individual from Kaffa imagined and understood the world around him. While one might imagine a sort of discomfort with so many approaches, Mikael seems to feel no malaise with these seemingly incongruous perceptions. It is his comfort with this myriad opinions, values, and practices that forces us to question the terms and categories we use in order to understand the people who lived in the 17th century Ottoman Empire, especially if we are to be able to try to imagine life through their eyes. Ultimately, this one case study insists upon an Armenian engagement not only with the Turkish language, but also with Turkish literature and many of its mystical and religious themes. Mikael's manuscript encourages us as historians to look beyond oversimplified notions of identity and towards the kind of blurred borders where people living in the Ottoman Empire and in a city like Kaffa came together and participated in a shared space, in part created by the Turkish language and its lyric tradition. Thank you.